Welcome to Talking Books on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and in this series I discuss books and what they mean to my guests on the program. I'm very happy to have with me in the studio today on Talking Books, Professor Dominic Fenech. Just a few words about my guest. Professor Fenech is Professor of Modern and Contemporary History. He's head of the Department of History and the Dean of the Faculty of Arts here at the University. He studied history as an undergraduate here at the University, and in 1974 he was elected Rhodes Scholar and continued his studies at the University of Oxford, where he completed his DPhil in 77 with a dissertation on modern Anglo-Vatican diplomatic relations. He returned to Malta and joined the university as a lecturer in 1979, teaching modern Maltese and international history with a focus on the Mediterranean. In 1986-87, he was elected Fellow of the Centre for International Studies at the London School of Economics and Political Science, where he pursued his interests in contemporary international relations in the Mediterranean. And thereafter, he launched and for a number of years directed Contemporary Mediterranean Studies at the University of Malta. Professor Fenech's main research and teaching interests are in the areas of contemporary Mediterranean politics and in Maltese political and constitutional history, as well as current political development. His recent publications include Endemic Democracy, the first volume of a study of Maltese political history in the interwar years. Besides his academic interests, Dominic Fenech is a regular contributor to public discussion and has a long-standing interest in journalism and the media. Welcome, Professor Fenech. An initial question that I like to ask all my guests who sit in that chair is about your introduction to books. I would ask you to cast your mind back not too far to your younger days. What was it that sparked your interest in books? Can you remember the first time that you really felt, gosh, yes, this I love this act of reading?
I think it was my mother, actually, who inspired my love for reading, because she was a voracious reader herself, even though she was self-schooled. But she had pen friends in Britain, and she learned English, and she always believed that by reading, people improve their English. So, although I don't come from a family with lots of education, but there were always books around, and probably that's where the first inspiration came from. But at school, we used to have also a good library for boys, of course, and I used to browse in this library and borrow books, and so there was always a book which I was reading, even when I was a boy at school. And of course, it's a bug which doesn't ever leave you, even though, of course, with time you have less and less time. You know, with the passing of time, you have less and less time for yourself to read books. Of course, I have embarked on a career, an academic career, which means that books are very much my staple tools, but of course I'm a historian, so I'm not in the world of literature, and most of the books which I have to read in connection with my work are not the books that I love to read, but the books that I need to read.
In fact, when I asked you about your interest in books or which books you would like to discuss on this program, I thought you might tell me, as some other scholars whom I have interviewed have said, that you read so much for your work that you don't have time for leisure reading, but that's obviously not quite the case for you.
Well, it's a pastime, it's a hobby. It is a hobby which is not a waste of time also. So I find it complements my work. It doesn't distract from my work. I mean, it's not the only hobby that I have. I like to do all sorts of other things, many of which are not in the least intellectual. But I think there's nothing like a nice book.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. I was pleasantly surprised, in fact, when you provided me with this really lovely, lovely list, which I read with interest, because I found a few old favourites of mine, and also several books which I was not at all acquainted with, so I've kept that list, and now I've put them on my must-read list as well. There were some authors that jumped out at me, really. For example, Julian Barnes. I think he's really great. What attracts you to him?
Well, I've read only two books by him, one of which I don't like at all, but the other, which I enjoyed reading greatly. It's The History of the World in 10 and a half chapters. And it's really a number of short stories connected by one feature, which is the Ark of Noah and the Great Deluge. It's a very funny book, and also reflective in parts. And I liked its irreverence, actually. Dealing with something which is quite archaic and serious and biblical, from so many different points of view.
Yes, he can be very amusing, and he does manage to get this link between sort of the serious and the funny.
Yes.
The Pedant in the Kitchen, which is I really enjoyed reading of his, is the same sort of thing, really.
I also like in particular the story of why the unicorn became extinct in one of his chapters. So, well, it's a bit rude, so I won't mention it on this program.
We'll give that a miss then. Another author is Ian McEwan, who I personally have a sort of love-hate relationship with. I find him a wonderful writer, a gripping, totally gripping writer. But I find him disturbing, which is, I suppose, exactly what he's supposed to do, disturb his reader into making them think. And so I read him not so much for pleasure as for penance. I don't know what you feel about that.
Well, there are two books in particular which I particularly liked and have left an effect on me. One is Enduring Love, which has this remarkable, this stunning opening. And just imagine what imagination it takes to start a story with a man being stranded on a balloon and actually has to jump in order to save himself. Well, the story is mostly, of course, about an obsessive homosexual love by someone towards another one. It's an unrequited love. But it's told with such effect and with such intensity, and it really brings out to the full the extent of how obsessive love how far it can actually go, to the point of even making miserable the life of the person you actually love. Reminds me a bit of John Fowles, The Collector, which is also partly similar.
I thought that also what upset me about it was the fragility of the relationship, in a way. I mean, she tries to keep going, but the fact that a relationship can be pushed to the edge by something or someone over whom there was no control, really.
Yes.
It's terrifying.
These things actually do happen in real life. Yes. I mean, I don't envy anybody who becomes the subject of this kind of enduring love.
Terrible.
The other one, which I liked a lot because it's also very topical, it was even more topical when it came out a few years ago, Saturday, which is about... Well, it's really about a neurologist, but and Ian McEwan is one author who does a hell of a lot of research in his writing. In fact, I had the pleasure to hear a reading of his in London when at the time that it was coming out. But it's also about the Iraqi war and this tension, this conflict inside the mind of an educated, of a thinking person, as to whether to support or to oppose the British intervention in Iraq. On one hand, you have an intervention based on lies, on claims of weapons of mass destruction, which everybody almost knew were not there. And at the same time, there is this idea of bringing democracy to an oppressed people, of overthrowing dictatorship. So the protagonist is torn between these two irreconcilable positions. But it's told so beautifully. It's told so persuasively.
The author, who I wasn't surprised really to see on your list, was David Lodge, because of course he writes campus novels, which I would imagine would be attractive to most people who live on a campus. I was attracted to him first by The British Museum is Falling Down, because funny book, and it was about Catholics in England, and I was amused in the 70s, living in England, to see that there were other Catholic families in England, because I didn't know any outside my school milieu. So I was quite amazed to see a book that was actually about them. Of course, he's written many books, and his trilogy with the Changing Places is one of his best. The story of Philip Swallow and Maurice Zapp. You were attracted to that because of its campus meanings, or not?
It's easy to read, very fast reading. It's funny. It's authentic, because David Lodge himself spent a lifetime in academia, and in fact, I believe the last job he held was as a teacher of creative writing. So he had been teaching literature apparently all his life, and then he thought, why don't I start actually making literature? And then he moved to some chair of creative writing. Well, I think one of the earliest appointments as a creative writer inside a university. I mean, at universities we dissect what other people write. We don't usually teach it. I hope we start teaching it even here. And I think that's one of the long-term plans of the Department of English here. Yes, and it's funny. It's realistic. Anybody who has been in a university environment knows what it means to staff exchange, student exchanges, the kind of quips at receptions, the pretensions, the airs, the false humility of academics. It is all there. The fragility of people. I mean, I remember the first book, Changing Places. The British character Peter, I think his name was, who envied his colleagues because they published so much. He never published anything, but he was a good teacher. So he took pride in how he set the examination questions, and he thought, maybe I could one day collect my examination papers and publish them. So, you know, this pressure to publish this. It is all there. He's always been studying very carefully and representing very theatrically, but also accurately, university life and university problems. Maybe in university life, realism and theatricalism are
intermingled.
The most recent work of his, which I read only last summer, was Death Sentence, which is also a campus novel. And it's Death Sentence because it's about a professor who is becoming deaf. So we got the funny side to that. But it's also making fun of himself, because he himself in real life is becoming deaf, so he knows exactly what he's talking about.
A very quick word, if one can ever have a quick word, about Gabriel Garcia Marquez. You mentioned 100 Years of Solitude, which I loved as a book, but I used it on aeroplanes because it needed concentration. With the people all had the same name, so you had to make very sure about that you knew who he was talking about. And of course, Love in the Time of the Cholera, which is his classic, really.
Yes, and there's a third one, which there are many, by Garcia Marquez. He was, of course quite popular in the 70s and 80s. Since then, a lot of good literature has come out of Latin America, and he was, in a sense, one of the people who brought that kind of genre of literature, which is very specific to Latin America, to the outside world, to the rest of the world. But the book which I liked most by him, which comes very close to being among my top five favorite books, is The Autumn of the Patriarch, which is about a retired dictator, overthrown dictator, actually. Remember, this was the 70s, when Latin America was one big college of dictatorships. And it's about this dictator who still lives in his past. He's retired, he's got all the comforts, he's being humored and so on, but he no longer has power. And in a sense, apart from the fascinating style in which it is written, it has no punctuation, sentences which last pages and pages, but it's so well designed that you don't need punctuation. This is a sign of good writing, of course. It's also, in a sense, a fictionalized book of political science, of Latin American political science, how politics functions or malfunctions in Latin America.
One set of books about which I'm afraid to say I knew absolutely nothing is the Scandinavian authors that you mentioned. And I was interested to see that your vacations, which you've had talked to us about in the common room, your trips to Iceland and I think Norway as well, seem to have inspired your interest in Scandinavian authors.
Well, I mean, it's nice to go to a country and then bring some books back with you. Scandinavian authors are not very well known. I mean, they're not very well known in the sense that they are not usually on bestseller lists. In particular, I'm very impressed by an author from my favorite Scandinavian country, where now my wife and I have been going, and we intend to go there again this summer, and maybe next summer, and hopefully the following summer. It's Iceland. As you know, Iceland is a very large island, but a population which is significantly smaller than ours. And yet they have produced very, very good authors, which have been translated in many languages, of course, starting with the English language. Their most famous literary son is Halldór Laxness, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature some years back with Independent People. I've just finished reading. I haven't read Independent People because it's a bit bleak, like some Scandinavian literature and like a lot of Scandinavian weather. But recently I have read Under the Glacier, which is an extremely, I wouldn't say funny, but certainly, strange novel. Brings out very much the Icelandic character, which can appear very grim, but at the same time never takes life all that seriously. Scandinavians live in a very big atmosphere. Their glaciers are big, their spaces are big, their roads are very long. Everything physical in Scandinavia, in Iceland, is large, except of course the population. But they're wonderful people, and extremely well educated. They're the best read people in the world, so they do come out with some very good works. I mean, Halldór Laxness is of course the one most well known because of his Nobel Prize. But there are many others, especially they like to write a lot about murder and these other thrillers. And this is strange because it's a country where there is no crime.
Well, I suppose that's the attraction.
There's absolutely no crime. You know, they have a jail which is most of the time closed, although now they're filling it up with their former bankers.
In the few minutes that we have left of our interview, I'd like to turn to the book, one of the main books that you I know you'd like to talk about. It's the historical novel genre that you've gone for, and as a historian, I was quite interested to see what kind of rapport you had with that genre.
I think that good historical fiction can be very complementary to good historical writing. I wouldn't advise anybody to learn their history from historical fiction, because historical fiction is fiction, and the author is not bound by the ethic of being accurate as the historian is in writing history. But a reasonably loyal piece of historical fiction gives an insight, gives a flavor into history, which the history book can never give. The history book is usually the grand narrative, where you have all the facts and you knit them together to see to make a sensible broad picture. But history is about the deeds of people, of human beings, of millions of human beings milling about, and between them creating an effect which we call history. But and each individual has his or her own history. One history can be very diverse from another. So although ultimately we see the whole picture, the big picture, but the small picture keeps reminding you that the big picture is only the sum of all these small pictures. If you want to portray suffering, for example, love, these very normal human emotions and experiences, the grand narrative doesn't give you those. And the fiction may be the fiction writer may be inventing the characters, but of course giving these characters realistic emotions, realistic experiences.
So we can turn to An Instance of the Finger Post by Ian Pearce. A bit of a doorstopper. I can see it on the desk in front of us.
Yes, well, it's a book which I haven't read recently. I read it about 10 years ago, I think. 19 years ago, when it first came out. But Ian Pearce is mostly known for his thrillers about art and, you know, theft of artworks and so on and so forth. Here he goes into Restoration England, 1663. The monarchy has been brought back. There's a lot of turmoil. The English society is still suffering from the bruises of the Civil War and the aftermath. It's staged in Oxford University, which I have an affinity with also because I studied there. In fact, a few books which I have read are actually staged at Oxford University. Oxford University is a very good setting for any novel, for any period. It incidentally also gives you an insight into how life as a student or as a don in Oxford was, for example, that rich people did not have to study. The only people who had to study were those people who were really trying to make it against all odds. That students literally slept in the same bed as their tutor, and all sorts of strange goings on. But there's so much to say about this book. One could probably make a whole program on it. And why I like it. I like it, of course, because it's a historical novel, and it is extremely loyal to the actual, to what was actually going on. It's told in four parts. It's really four books. Four people telling the same story. It's a murder thriller. But four people telling the same story. One is a doctor. It's actually something else, but I won't spoil the fun for anyone wanting to read it. One is a doctor, a Venetian doctor. The other is a fictitious character. The other is a lawyer who tells the same story, who eventually goes mad. Then the other two are actual real historical figures. John Wallis was a mathematician. He was the one who came just before Isaac Newton. He was considered to be a prodigy in his time. And he's the person who Isaac Newton referred to when he says, "I can see very far because I sit on the shoulders of giants." John Wallis was the giant, but Isaac Newton was a humble person, whereas John Wallis wasn't. John Wallis reacted to what Isaac Newton said about sitting on the shoulders of giants. He said, "Yes, even a dwarf can sit on the shoulders of a giant." And the fourth character is a historian. And let me say that he's the one who really gets it right.
That would have pleased you.
So, yeah, but he's an anti-hero, you see. And that's Anthony Wood, who was the historian of Oxford University eventually. Very, very, very famous historian. And it's about the murder of one of the Dons, of one of the Oxford Dons. And the interesting thing is how each of these four raconteurs reach their conclusions by applying their own prejudices or their own skills. So the lawyer reasons as a lawyer and makes his deductions from points from the, as a lawyer would do, and reaches the conclusion that X committed the murder. The mathematician, who is the great calculator, uses his mathematical brain to reach a conclusion which to him is inconfutable. To him, mathematics cannot make any mistakes. And reasoning like a mathematician, therefore, must lead you to the truth. Well, I'll stop there because I'm tempted to say why and how the historian actually operates. But it's a brilliant book, and it's also a book of historiographical interest. So it's not just a historical novel. It's not just a wonderful thriller, a gripping thriller. It's not just a very good historical novel. It's not just a great work of literature, in my view. But it's also a historiographical work for those who are interested in looking at the historiographical part, because it tells you, it tells all about the pitfalls in one's search for the truth. People write what they think is the truth in history, under the influence of prejudice, under the influence of self-interest, under the influence of hidden agendas, but most importantly, under the influence of their own subjective perception. But of course, history ought really to be objective if that is an attainable aim at all.
Well, after that inspiring description of this book, I really must repeat the title, An Instance of the Finger Post by Ian Pierce. And that brings us to the end of the program. Thank you very, very much, Professor Dominic Pinnick, for coming to share your book insights with us.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Thank you for listening to Talking Books. I hope you can join us next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.